Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Congress is pushing for stronger laws against domestic terrorism. Many human rights groups say don't.
We're pretty confident that when those laws get put in place, they're not necessarily going to be going after the Proud Boys.
Also today, more Brazilians are calling for their president to go. They say when it comes to the pandemic, Jair Bolsonaro has simply not delivered.
To receive vaccines for all, to strengthen the public health care system, this will not happen with this president.
And thanks to Brexit, fish from Scotland risk rotting at the port. Scottish fishermen are telling British politicians that if they can't export their fish,
we will be at the gates of Westminster and we'll be dumping our shellfish on your doorstep, rotten.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Happy Monday, and we're glad as always to have you with us. We start today with news of the most recent head of state to test positive for COVID-19. Mexico's Andrés Manuel López Obrador said on Sunday that he's being treated for mild symptoms. He said he was optimistic and was isolating at home. His Interior Secretary, Olga Sánchez Cordero, spoke on his behalf.
Se encuentra bien, se encuentra fuerte.
She says the president is strong and will continue to fulfill his duties from isolation. For more on this, we turn to The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, in Mexico City. So, Jorge, another head of state is now infected. What do we know about President López Obrador's health and the work he's still tending to while he's sick?
Well, President López Obrador is a member of a high-risk group for a couple of factors. One of them is his age. He is 67 years old. And perhaps more importantly, he had a heart attack 8 years ago. Now, his Interior Secretary really belabored the point this morning that he is in good health, that he is continuing to work from isolation. And most notably, he was on the phone this morning with President Vladimir Putin of Russia to speak about the Sputnik vaccine, because Mexico's health officials are evaluating the vaccine for use here in Mexico.
So AMLO has some comorbidities. Has López Obrador been vaccinated yet?
He has not. Mexico began vaccines just a few weeks ago, and the country is still in phase one, which means that the vaccines are being given to health workers. Now, a second phase is scheduled to begin in February, which includes people older than the age of 60. And President López Obrador said that he is just going to wait his turn, and he's not going to cut in line.
So we know the president has rarely been seen wearing a face mask in public. He's kept a busy public schedule, too, through the pandemic. Are the people who've seen him and have been around him recently, are they testing and isolating, as public health officials are recommending?
Some of them are, at the very least. For example, the president was with his interior secretary, with his foreign relations secretary on Friday for a phone call with newly sworn in President Joe Biden. And both of those cabinet members have said that they were tested on Sunday, that they will be tested again later this week. But the president had a busy schedule this weekend, as he usually does. He flew commercial flights and he went to Monterrey, which is a northern part of Mexico, where he met with the governor of the state there. And that governor said that he's just going to monitor his symptoms. And if he starts showing any symptoms, then he will be tested. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag, Marco.
If we take the case of Mexico, Jorge, how much does a head of state's example and modeling influence people's behavior around pandemic safety measures? What have you seen?
Well, there was a study published by a professor at New York University just a few weeks ago that found a correlation between national identity and support for response to the pandemic. That study included Mexico, so one could reason that President López Obrador's refusal to wear face masks, his continuing to have a busy meeting schedule, has had an influence on people here. At the very least, what many public health experts agree, both inside and outside of the country, is that President López Obrador's handling of the pandemic is largely to blame for the situation here. The head of the World Health Organization just a couple of months ago pleaded with Mexico's leaders to provide a better example. And the situation that we are facing right now is that the country is vying for second place and the highest number of deaths because of the coronavirus. And here in Mexico City, hospitals are at or near capacity. There are oxygen tank shortages throughout the entire region. So I think that what many, many people are hoping is that both the president will get through this and so will his country.
The world's Jorge Valencia in Mexico City. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
In Brazil, many people are unhappy with their president's handling of the pandemic. So unhappy, in fact, big crowds went out to protest this weekend, demanding the removal of President Jair Bolsonaro. In Brazil, more than 215,000 people have died of COVID-19. Globally, that's second only to the United States. As Michael Fox reports from Brazil, calls for impeachment there seem to be gaining traction.
A sound truck leads a seemingly endless line of vehicles down the street in Belo Horizonte, the capital of Minas Gerais. A huge yellow banner flaps in the wind. It reads, "Bolsonaro Impeachment Now." A group of people in masks cheer on the side of the road. This is just one of dozens of caravans held over the weekend against President Jair Bolsonaro, and one of countless videos posted of the protests on Twitter. In another, from the country's capital, Brasilia, Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann speaks on top of a sound truck speeding along a highway past residential neighborhoods. She wears a white face mask adorned with the insignia of the universal healthcare system, SUS, in bold letters. She says, "This is the caravan for the impeachment of Bolsonaro. Because to receive vaccines for all, to strengthen the public healthcare system, to have income and work, this will not happen with this president. This president is genocidal." The caravans were not just run by Bolsonaro's longtime adversaries on the left, but also by some of his former allies. In this video posted online on Sunday, a line of cars rolls down Sao Paulo's Paulista Avenue. A woman on the mic says, "Enough of the irresponsibility, enough of the conflict." These same groups supported Bolsonaro and were responsible for some of the largest street protests against Workers' Party President Dilma Rousseff in the lead-up to her impeachment in 2016. The increasing calls for Bolsonaro's impeachment come just a week after a devastating spike in COVID-19 cases in the city of Manaus, which packed ICU wards. Oxygen ran out, some patients died, others were transferred to other states. The city is still battling with more than 3,000 new cases a day. A lockdown begins today. Political science professor Luciana Santana says multiple factors are causing outrage and propelling people to the streets. The crisis in Manaus, the slow start to the vaccination campaign, which only began last week, and even the news from Washington.
O que aconteceu nos Estados Unidos, né, no último mês, pedidos de impeachment, né, que...
She says everything that's happened in the U.S. over the last month, the impeachment requests in the United States, the anti-democratic movements that invaded the U.S. Capitol, all of this international context has started to reflect here, considering that Trump was one of the inspirations for the Brazilian president. Bolsonaro was uncharacteristically silent in response to this weekend's protests. On Sunday, Bolsonaro went for a motorcycle ride around Brasilia. In this video posted online, two journalists ask him what he thinks about the protests and the drop in his popularity. He tries to ignore them as he gets back on his bike and speeds off, flanked by security guards. Bolsonaro's approval rating fell nearly a dozen points in a new poll released Friday, down to only 26%. Two reports also broke last week that have generated even greater outrage. First, it was leaked that Bolsonaro's government had refused an early offer from Pfizer to sell Brazil 70 million doses of its vaccine. Then, a scathing University of Sao Paulo study of the government's handling of the pandemic revealed that there was a, quote, institutional strategy to spread coronavirus, with the goal of quickly reopening Brazil's economy at any cost. Again, here's Luciana Santana. She says, it's an important study, and I would say that it strengthens even more the arguments and evidence for the opening of an impeachment process. More than half of Brazilians say they would support Bolsonaro's impeachment. More than 60 impeachment requests have been delivered to the Speaker of the lower house, Rodrigo Maia. He's already said he won't take action, but an election for a new House Speaker will take place on February 1st. If Bolsonaro's candidate loses, it may open the door for the process to move ahead. But Bolsonaro's government is apparently doing damage control, preparing a new communications plan and lobbying more centrist members of Congress. What comes next is anyone's guess. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
It is an important anniversary in Egypt today, a decade since hopes of revolution bloomed. In early 2011, millions of Egyptians protested against the government of Hosni Mubarak. They called for political freedom, human rights, and economic reform. Those protesters succeeded in running Mubarak from power, but aside from that, 10 years on, not much else has changed. Egypt today is ruled by a similarly autocratic government under President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Joining me now is May El-Sadani. She's a human rights lawyer with the Tahrir Institute in Washington. So let's start with the human rights situation in Egypt, May. What is it like right now? How do things compare to a decade ago?
Egypt is currently in one of its worst moments in, with regards to human rights. There's a tightening space for expression. What started as arresting protesters, maybe pushing political messaging or pushing for political change, has now turned into even prosecuting influencers using TikTok for allegedly violating family values. So you've seen this evolution, if you will, of a constricting space, not just in the political, but even in the academic, even in the artistic. Certainly also when it comes to the right to protest, there's a protest law that's been passed that has severely constricted the right to protest, which has meant that we've seen less protests. And when protests have occurred, you've seen widespread arrests. You're also seeing an abuse of a counterterrorism legislation, a counterterrorism framework. Even nonviolent individuals like lawyers are being accused of joining terrorist organizations when in actuality, all they're doing is representing their clients or documenting what they're seeing on social media. So effectively, you're seeing laws passed to normalize human rights violations so that those violations aren't just occurring in an ad hoc basis, but almost via the law, if you will, which is extremely dangerous.
I mean, in the past, Sisi was described by Trump as his favorite dictator. No doubt the rhetorical tone under Biden will be different, but practically, what will change in the relations between Washington and Cairo, given what you've just described?
A lot of observers have a lot of hope in the Biden administration. Many were heartened to see the tweet of then nominee Antony Blinken. When the members of one of Egypt's most renowned NGOs were arrested, he spoke out in support of them. So many are hoping for more human rights oriented messaging. And if the campaign and what we've seen so far is any indication, then we're headed in the right direction.
When Egyptians look back today on everything that's happened in the past 10 years, what do they see? Is it a lost opportunity that won't come again, or is the hope of a better future and organizing around that? Does that still exist?
It's a feeling of ups and downs. It's a feeling of immense pride, but also immense, this feeling of being let down by so many political actors, by being let down by a regime that continues to hurt its own people, even when that's against its own interests. It's a lot of ups and downs, but I'm grateful to have lived vicariously online through this moment. I am so proud of my friends and loved ones who are in the streets. I'm so humbled at the journalists, the NGO workers, the lawyers who continue to resist in their own ways, in minor ways that maybe don't make it to the headlines, but there's forms of resistance and immensely important work being done until this day, even in the midst of the human rights situation that I shared with you earlier. And so I'm humbled by them, I'm inspired by them. And if they're not giving up, then what right do I have to give up as an Egyptian American here in DC trying to do my part?
May El-Sadani is a human rights lawyer with the Tahrir Institute in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for coming on and speaking with us, May.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me and for telling these stories.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Brexit. I'll bet you thought we were done with that. Signed, sealed, and delivered on New Year's, right? Well, now we get to turn our attention to the impacts of the UK leaving the European Union, both the intended and unintended consequences, from trade to travel to studying abroad. Today we turn to Scottish fishermen. The industry says it's close to declaring bankruptcy. That's because truckloads of Scottish fish have been stuck at ports on both sides of the English Channel. And now the fishermen are saying that Brexit, the deal many of them voted for, is a far cry from what they were promised. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has our report.
On January 1st, the British public was prepared for news reports about long delays at airports and seaports. But the pandemic meant transport hubs were pretty quiet. The first real evidence of the impact of Brexit came from Scottish fish producers. Lorry loads of fish were delayed for hours, sometimes days, at the ports, due to all the extra paperwork and customs checks now required. Fishermen like Jamie McMillan took to Twitter to express his fury.
My blood is boiling. There's boats tied up. There's families fishing boats tied up. We can't get our product to the EU market because of red tape, extra paperwork. It's an absolute disgrace what we've had to go through.
If the UK government doesn't solve the problem soon, McMillan said, he would take the matter to London.
Prime Minister, I can assure you, if Scottish exporters can't get their product to market next week, we will be at the gates of Westminster and we'll be dumping our shellfish on your doorstep, rotten.
Days later, around 50 Scottish producers did drive a cavalcade of trucks to the British capital, circling the roads around 10 Downing Street. No fish were dumped in Westminster, but some Conservative MPs, like Jacob Rees-Mogg, still fail to appreciate just how angry the industry has become.
The government is tackling this issue, is dealing with it as quickly as possible, and the key is we've got our fish back. They're now British fish, and they're better and happier fish for it.
For over 4 years, the Scottish fishing industry has been fed one message from those in favour of Brexit, like British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
I'm here at Grimsby Fish Market, where I've been looking at the incredible opportunity this country has to take back control of its territorial waters.
Take back control of our waters. That was the slogan of the Vote Leave campaign in the Brexit referendum, and it worked. Over 90% of British fishermen are said to have voted in favour of leaving the EU. Scottish fisherman Jimmy Buchan was one of them.
Brexit to me means a rebalance of a wrongdoing from 40 years ago.
Fishermen like Buchan believe they've been treated unfairly by the European Union for years. When it came to fishing quotas, British fishermen say they got the short end of the stick. Here's Buchan speaking to the BBC in 2016.
I think it's a bad day and a bad deal that our rights has been traded away by our politicians, and we get less of that share than what our European counterparts get.
Buchan is now the CEO of the Scottish Seafood Association. I ask him if he regrets voting for Brexit.
I still support that Brexit was a great aspiration to have.
But Buchan, like so many fishermen in Scotland right now, feels let down by the government.
I'm extremely disappointed with the outcome. I do think the Prime Minister sold the industry short.
Some fishermen are now taking drastic action to try and get their fish to Europe. This is James Withers, CEO of trade body Scotland Food and Drink.
Those that are out fishing, some of them are spending 48 hours to sail from UK waters over to Denmark to land fish in markets in Denmark, because then the product can be traded within the single market and can be trucked down to Spain.
Fish producers worry that if problems continue, buyers in Europe will lose faith in the Scottish industry. Withers tells me some clients have already turned temporarily to other markets.
So we know that seafood buyers in France have gone to Denmark and Norway for product instead of coming to Scotland and the rest of the UK.
The delays couldn't come at a worse time. The pandemic has already seen a sharp downturn in business with the closure of so many restaurants. Scottish fisherman Alistair Sinclair hasn't taken his boat out since March of last year. Sinclair, who's also national coordinator of the Scottish Creel Fishermen's Federation, believes the French are making it more difficult for the Brits.
I personally feel that the French are trying to give us a bloody nose on this one, in as much as Macron has actually said that he will defend his fishermen's right to fish wherever they wish to fish in the North Sea.
The new trade deal signed in December between Britain and the EU means European boats could be banned from UK waters from 2026. But fishermen worry that the European Union will retaliate with other measures if Britain tries to ban EU boats. They want the government to sit down once again with the EU to iron out the current delays. Boris Johnson has agreed to offer some compensation, but the industry says it's not enough. Jimmy Buchan, who voted for Brexit, now concedes the deal agreed is bad for the industry.
This was a negotiation. But I'm not going to dress it up any other way. It was a terrible outcome, and we have paid a heavy price.
Fisherman Alistair Sinclair tells me the last month has made him consider hanging up his nets for good.
I'm actually in the process of thinking of getting rid of the boat. Nobody knows how the cards are going to fall on this one. And if we're going to be revisiting the situation in 5 years' time, things could get an awful lot more difficult.
Even if all the red tape gets sorted, it's unlikely to be the end of the government's Brexit headache. Meat producers are now reporting long border delays. Supermarkets in Northern Ireland are experiencing food shortages. And there's also the prospect of a Scottish independence referendum on the cards, something Boris Johnson certainly doesn't want. But he's a long way to go to convince fishermen in Scotland to put their trust in him once more. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
A quick coronavirus travel update. Former President Trump had called for easing travel restrictions starting tomorrow. Now that's not happening. President Biden is reinstating restrictions on travelers from Brazil, Ireland, the UK, and 26 other European countries. The move is designed to try and stop the spread of disease and new variants of the coronavirus. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki spoke earlier today.
With the pandemic worsening and more contagious variants spreading, this isn't the time to be lifting restrictions on international travel. And in light of the contagious variant, B1351, South Africa has been added to the restricted list.
The nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, called the decision prudent. Every morning, the producers, reporters, and editors here at The World discuss and debate the most important stories that we need to cover. Get in on the early warning system for the global news we're thinking about each morning. Sign up for our newsletter, Top of the World, at theworld.org/newsletters. And coming up later in the program, Korean pop turns into Kazakh pop, just don't call it K-pop, and Russian protesters take to the streets calling for change. You're listening to The World. President Biden has lifted a ban against trans people serving in the U.S. military. For the ones who have served, the hope is that this sends a message that if you're qualified, you'll be accepted.
To be quite frank, I don't care if there are people who have personal animosity towards a service member that they may be working with who is transgender. They need to get over it.
That's coming up later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Biden administration and lawmakers in Washington are taking a harder look at the threat of domestic terrorism. This urgency came out of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, of course. Some say it's time for new U.S. laws against domestic terrorism. But as the world's Rupesh Shenoy reports, dozens of human rights groups are warning lawmakers against doing just that.
Under U.S. federal law, it's a lot easier to investigate and charge someone for international terrorism than it is for domestic terrorism. There's no statute that establishes criminal penalties solely for domestic terrorism. That's in part because, in the past, lawmakers have worried about infringing on Americans' freedom of speech. But the January 6th assault on the Capitol has many advocating for new laws that would make it easier to pursue and charge people as domestic terrorists. In response, human rights groups are pushing back. Maya Berry is executive director of the Arab American Institute, one of the organizations that signed the letter to lawmakers opposing the expansion of existing terrorism laws.
As well-intended as it is, we're pretty confident that when those laws get put in place, they're not necessarily going to be going after, you know, the Proud Boys per se. It's much more likely that it would be Arab Americans, American Muslims, Black Lives Matter protesters. It's just a pattern that we regrettably are quite familiar with.
For instance, the FBI surveilled Martin Luther King Jr. and infiltrated the Black Panthers. After 9/11, authorities wiretapped and detained people without warrants. They profiled and targeted Muslim Americans and other people of color in the name of national security. Berry says new laws giving law enforcement more authority would just lead to more abuses. She says there are already many laws on the books that allow authorities to go after white extremists effectively. They just don't use the legal term terrorism.
It's not a situation where I need to call it terrorism in order for it to be taken seriously. We can take it seriously without that.
But Berry says federal law enforcement hasn't been taking white extremists seriously and hasn't been fully enforcing existing laws, despite the dramatic rise in hate crimes against people of color and the increasing pace of incidents involving white nationalists.
You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
Like the 2017 demonstration in Charlottesville, Virginia, that led to the death of a young woman who was killed by a right-wing activist. And the 2018 shooting at the Pittsburgh Tree of Life Synagogue, where a gunman killed 11 people. And the 2019 attack on a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, where a shooter targeting Latinos killed 22 people.
There have been very specific examples of white supremacist violence that should have, you know, warranted a more serious response. We just need the will to really take that threat more seriously and do that before we talk about the law change.
I would love to respond to that.
Tom O'Connor was an FBI agent who worked on white supremacist criminal activity and domestic terrorism until he retired in 2019. He says law enforcement has done everything it can under existing laws, and it hasn't been enough.
In the 23 years that I worked domestic extremists, no one was ever charged as being a domestic terrorist, and that's what they should be charged with.
O'Connor says allowing criminal charges for domestic terrorism would send a message that violence motivated by politics or hate isn't acceptable, whether it's committed with a gun or a weapon of mass destruction.
By making domestic political violence a criminal offense under federal law, you're not adding any investigative or surveillance authorities to law enforcement. You are just making the crime of political violence illegal in the United States.
Some of the proposed legislation would put a review board in place to help prevent law enforcement abuses like those that have occurred in the past, says Jason Blazekas, former director of the State Department's Counterterrorism Office. He's now director of Middlebury Institute's Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism.
Unfortunately, I think there's kind of a knee-jerk reaction against the possibility of a domestic terrorism law. I think there are a lot of people who don't really understand that it can be narrowly tailored.
As things are now, he says white suspects aren't called terrorists as often as black and brown people.
And I think that creates a really nasty optic.
He says it exacerbates existing racial inequities.
So I think there is an important symbolic value to a domestic terrorism update that will allow for the United States to start considering, quite frankly, white people as terrorists, too, not just brown or black people or people who may worship a certain faith.
That doesn't persuade Maya Berry of the Arab American Institute.
I appreciate it when people are saying we want to call it the same thing to kind of in some ways vindicate your community. Okay, I mean, fine. If that's you feel strongly about that, that's great. For me, though, it's about doubling down on a deeply flawed and highly discriminatory counterterrorism regime that we've had in place.
Berry says the U.S. can deal with domestic terrorism without new laws that will only further harm the very communities that white extremists target. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
From Moscow, all the way to Vladivostok in Russia's Far East. Across 11 time zones, Russians came out to the streets to protest the arrest of opposition politician Alexei Navalny. Navalny is arguably Russian President Vladimir Putin's harshest critic. Protesters see Navalny's arrest as a cynical political move, and they say the charges against him were fabricated by the Kremlin. We're joined now by Russian political scientist Ekaterina Shulman. She's in Moscow. First of all, remind us why Navalny was arrested in the first place. He just landed in Moscow from Berlin over a week ago, where he'd been recuperating from poisoning.
Yes, he returned to Russia as he has promised, and he was detained during passport control at the request of Russian Federal Penitentiary Service. He's been, for the last 5 years, under suspended sentence on probation term, following the old court case known as the affair of Yves Rocher, the French cosmetics company. So the Federal Penitentiary Service considers him to have violated the rules of his probation term, and if the court agrees with that, then he's going to get 3.5 years of real prison sentence. This is the legal frame of what is happening.
So Navalny's arrest was more than a week ago. Let's jump now to Saturday, 2 days ago. You went out in the streets during these protests over the weekend, thousands of people in Moscow alone. What did you see? What were your impressions?
Yes, I was there as an observer, and it reminded me a lot of what I've seen in 2019. There was a great number of people for an unsanctioned event, an event that has not been approved. This was by far the largest public gathering since, I think, 2012. Here, people had no legal protection, and there was high risk of arrests that have materialized. The demography of those out in the streets very much resembled the general demography of the population. The most numerous strata being those from 25 to 45. There were a lot of young faces, but not extremely young.
What does that tell us, though, about the age of people who are out protesting and their attitude toward the Kremlin?
Well, evidently, those people who joined protests are oppositionally inclined, but they were not predominantly school children. I would rather cite another figure that struck me as important was that 42% of respondents said that it was their first protest event. Usually, the percentage of the first comers is not so high.
So we saw mass arrests with these demonstrations into the thousands. Also, we saw protesters throwing snowballs at police. How did the police approach the demonstrators? And did you get the sense that protesters were taking greater risks than in the past with police?
Well, I saw the snowballing of police cars and of those lines of riot police officers who come to grab some protester or other and take them into their cars. I have not seen myself with my own eyes any violence, but from the videos I saw instances of what could be termed police violence, but I must say that in 2019 I've seen worse. Whether the protesters were more aggressive this time? Well, the violent part happened later in the day, between 6 and 7 p.m., that some clashes happened and a car belonging to a high-ranking FSB official had its windows broken. This had not happened before.
You had not seen that before?
No.
Well, the protests happened not just in Moscow and St. Petersburg. They were all across Russia, at least a dozen I saw. What does that tell you?
The geography of the protests this Saturday has been unprecedented. This is a very much a new thing. For many towns and cities in central Russia, it's been the first comparatively numerous public gathering since the 90s. This is significant. It's really too early for conclusions, but it's not too early to say that this is both new and important.
Ekaterina, if Alexei Navalny stays in prison, if the government continues to crack down on protesters, how does this all change the state of the Russian opposition going forward? And how could any of this have an impact on Russia's political future?
Oh, the nearest important thing in Russia's political future are the parliamentary elections of this autumn. They are by far the most important political event of the year. Alexei Navalny handles a tool called smart voting, which enables him to influence the outcome of elections which he or his supporters do not participate in directly. So no matter if he stays in prison or if he's let go free or maybe he's under house arrest, still elections will take place. And the voter, being in the mood he or she currently is in, will be searching for any option to vote against United Russia.
United Russia, that is Vladimir Putin's party, correct?
Yes, this is the party of current parliamentary majority, the party in power, the one that is going to make a fight to retain its position in the next Duma.
Russian political scientist Ekaterina Shulman speaking with us about the protests over the weekend across Russia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Trans people may once again serve openly in the U.S. Armed Services. President Biden made that official today. The executive order reverses a ban President Trump imposed in 2017. Jordan Blisk is a trans person who served in the U.S. Air Force as a senior airman from 2011 to 2015. Jordan, both emotionally and practically, how is this going to change lives?
Absolutely. So emotionally, I mean, I can speak for myself in saying, as someone who served under the original trans ban and, left service a little bit hastily in order to do what I felt like I needed to do and to transition, this would have made a world of difference for me. And I know personally so many individuals that are going to have their horizons expanded. You know, the military isn't just a job. It's a way out and it's a way up for a lot of people that don't have easy access to healthcare, employment, educational opportunities, et cetera. Trans people face monumental degrees of disenfranchisement in society. We're twice as likely to be unemployed, half as likely to have a college degree. Poverty rates were almost double the general population even before COVID hit. And then there's some evidence to suggest that we've been even more disproportionately affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. And so, you know, the military, it goes beyond just a job. It's a way of life for people. And it really offers opportunities that you may not have access to. I know it did for me. The military was my stepping stone to a better life. And without it, I know there's a 0.0 chance I would have ever been in a place to believe that I could ever become a lawyer.
Jordan, we've also been reminded of the presence of some repressive mindsets in the military when we saw the insurrection on Capitol Hill on January 6th, mindsets that may not be that friendly to transgender people. Will today's executive order have any hit on morale in some parts of the military? And how do we fix that larger problem?
I think it could. But I think that ultimately, what this executive order does is set the tone that the military needs to follow. One thing that really excites me about this executive order and other recent moves by the Biden administration is a return to data-driven approaches to policy. The 2016 DOD study on transgender military service found that there were no impacts to operational effectiveness or unit cohesion in foreign militaries that allow trans people to serve. I think over 20 countries do currently. So we're really not risking anything or experimenting, you know, with the safety of our troops. In recent years, the military really has done its homework on this question, and we know the answer to whether trans people should be able to serve. And I think at this point, trans service really isn't a question of military readiness, it's one of bias. And so to be quite frank, I don't care if there are people who have personal animosity towards a service member that they may be working with who is transgender. They need to get over it. There's no place in the military for that to impact operational readiness, because that trans person's presence isn't going to, but that bias could.
You were not out when you served, Jordan. When you did come out as trans, what role did the military play in helping you understand your gender identity?
Yeah, so that's actually a really good question. So I grew up in an extremely conservative area where the gender roles that I was taught were extremely traditional. I knew from a very early age, and not all trans people do by any means, but for me, I was very stubbornly gender nonconforming child. I don't know if I had the language to say I'm a boy. I definitely didn't have the words to say I'm a trans boy, but I knew who I was. Mm. And, you know, that process of going through the military and kind of having an opportunity to be seen in a way that gender wasn't the focus. When you get into the military, to some extent, there's a level of colorblindness or blindness towards race and towards gender. You do your job, you meet your standards, and that's what's expected of you. And we really try not to judge differently because of those things. And I think that can be a good and a bad thing. But one of the amazing things that it really did for me was, you know, allowing me to figure out who I was outside of pushing back against gendered constructs that I had experienced before. I felt so much freedom being called by my last name, for example, my rank and my last name instead of my birth name. And I think that was one thing that really made me realize I actually don't like being called by this name. You know, I'd never really felt that discomfort until I got used to being called Airman Blisk. And then similarly, like uniforms tend to be not super, super heavily gendered, at least the ones that I wore as a mechanic. We didn't really wear fancy dress uniforms very often. So, you know, when I was in uniform, I had short hair, and a lot of times unintentionally, people would read me as male, you know, so sir this, sir that, because, you know, the military, it's heavy on sir, ma'am, those types of things. And, you know, when I was getting sir'd a lot, it felt right. And I didn't know that would feel right. And I was scared by the fact that felt right. But there were so many opportunities in the military that allowed me to explore who I was and to figure out how my gender fit into my sense of self.
That's really interesting. I'm wondering if you think that kind of non-judgmental space will pick back up and continue to evolve in a positive way in the military now.
I certainly hope so. Yeah. I mean, I think that like that kind of colorblindness mindset that I described, it can have some problems because I think that people are different and diversity is strength. I don't see difference as deficiency. I think it's an opportunity for us to be our best, our most ready. But at the same time, I do think that there is a level where as a trans person, as a queer person, as a person of color, as all of the identity labels that I could stack on, I primarily want to feel like someone sees me as a person first and foremost and not as those labels. I mean, to know me, to understand who I am, you have to understand those things, but I want to be seen and treated with the same dignity and respect given to anyone else. And so hopefully this order sends a message to the military that says trans people are welcome, trans people are qualified, trans people belong, and make it happen.
Jordan Blisk is a former senior airman in the U.S. Air Force. He's a trans man who served from 2011 to 2015. He's also on the board of the Minority Veterans of America. Jordan Blisk, good to speak with you again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
If you listen to us a lot, you know we're fans of K-pop. Korean boy band BTS with their 2020 smash Dynamite. That tune and K-pop generally have swept the globe and inspired new acts, which brings us to the emerging pop sounds of Central Asia and a K-pop inspired band that has sparked some controversy. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier with more.
If you are a K-pop fan, this song may sound familiar. Similar to K-pop, this neo-disco track relies heavily on a synthesizer, while a chorus of high-energy boy band members sing replicable notes. But these lyrics aren't in Korean, they're in the Kazakh language. And this isn't K-pop, it's Q-pop. Kazakh starts with a Q in Latin, and a band named 91, who sings this song, has pioneered the genre in the Central Asian country of Kazakhstan. Aside from K-pop, band member Bala says they get inspiration from a number of people. But if he had to pick just one...
Michael Jackson.
And just like the King of Pop, 91 isn't shy with their fashion choices. So when they made their debut in 2015, they not only made headlines for their catchy tracks, but also for their appearance.
They have colorful clothes sometimes. They have hair of different color. And sometimes they wear makeup and some jewelry, which is not for Kazakh traditional audience, not acceptable.
Yevgenia Plakina is a Kazakhstan native who co-produced a documentary on the band. She says this androgynous look wasn't acceptable because it went against what a, quote, traditional Kazakh man looks like. For many people, that ideal stems from cultural norms formed when Kazakhstan declared independence from the USSR in the early 90s. According to Mireo Tan, a culture and arts professor at Taraz State University in Kazakhstan.
After the collapse of the USSR, people turn to religion, to traditional norms, and the population became more conservative. The masculinity norms are very prevailing in the country, and people can face backlash.
91 has faced their fair share of backlash, which has been covered in local and national news. Yevgenia Plakina says 91 has also faced backlash from critics who think they represent homosexuality, which, she says, also goes against conservative Kazakh views.
I think that it both triggers the gender norms and also triggers homophobes.
91 band member Zach says they didn't expect to spark these conversations.
Негизи эң басында биз сахнага жайгана өнөр көрсөтүү үчүн келген болатынбыз, ягъни.
He says we originally came to the stage just to perform, to sing, to make a show. To be honest, this is really a personal problem for the people who started this conflict. Perhaps these are some of their own fears, judging by the fact that they made such a stir. The boys of 91 say they're not trying to destroy Kazakh traditions, as some opponents suggest. For instance, they sing almost exclusively in the Kazakh language, which the country's government has been working to promote after seeing declining fluency. Nods to Kazakh traditions are commonly featured in their music videos, and their name, 91, is an homage to the year Kazakhstan gained independence. Band member Zach says, I think what unites society and reminds you of who you are your roots, your culture, your language. So including these things is very important to us. Despite this defense, opponents of the band have tried to mute them. First, one concert got canceled. Then protesters demanded more cancellations and showed up outside of venues saying they didn't want the band to perform. You can hear two groups here, chanting outside of an arena. One is objecting to the band, the other is defending them. Eventually, 91 supporters outnumbered the protesters. All of the Kazakhstan natives I spoke with say the band's rising popularity has triggered talks about gender identity, gender expression, and sexuality among the general public. Zach says although that wasn't their mission, the band is happy to start those conversations.
Қуаныштымыз, өйткені егер де мәселелер бар болса, онда ол мәселелерді шынымен де мойындап, ол мәселелерге жай ғана.
He says if such problems really exist, then we need to admit their existence and not just close our eyes to them. We need to accept that and look for a solution. Some people say the boys of 91 aren't doing enough to look for that solution. Haider Muhit is a transgender man from Kazakhstan and recently wrote a blog post about the controversy surrounding 91. He says the band isn't addressing the systemic LGBTQ issues in the country.
They aren't explicitly bringing attention to the problems that gay, lesbian, queer, trans people face. That would be obviously a lot more risque.
Still, hundreds of thousands of fans, who call themselves Eagles, are loyal to the band. Hits like their latest song, Taboo, have taken 91's fame to nearby countries like Turkey, Azerbaijan, and Turkmenistan. There's even a fan club in Bolivia. Band member Ace says international recognition is their goal.
Кей-поп осындай қарқынмен дами берсе, үлкен субкультура болатын күші бар. Қазақ музыкасы, тіпті бүкіл қазақ мәдениеті үлкен трансформацияға ұшырауы.
He says, if K-pop continues to develop at such a pace, it has the real potential to become a big and unique subculture. The identity of the Kazakh youth will become clear, and our music will be valued at the world level. K-pop can help make that happen. Another member of 91, Alam, says they know that popularity isn't something to handle lightly.
Танымалдық деген бұл жай ғана сезім емес,
He says, what you say in life, in songs, this is a message that you deliver to people. So popularity is cool, but for us, it's a very big responsibility. That responsibility is not solely on their shoulders. There are now dozens of bands and solo artists producing Q-pop music, and a growing international population of music lovers to support them. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The new Kazakh Pop takes us out today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Stay safe, be strong, and we're back with you tomorrow with more news and stories from around the world. Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.